Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Mark Lohr to the broadcast. Mark is the founder and CEO of Jet, the online marketplace that will take advantage of the economics of online shopping to create a new business model promising the lowest prices on the internet. The company officially launches the day we're broadcasting, July 13th, 2015. The company has raised over $220 million in funding. Prior to Jet, Mark was the co-founder and CEO of Quidsy, the parent company of e-commerce websites Diapers.com, Soap.com, and Wag.com, among others. The company was founded in 2005 and sold to Amazon in 2011 for $550 million. Mark was also the co-founder and CEO of The Pit Incorporated, an internet market-making collectible company, which sold to the Topps Company in 2001. Mark has received a wide array of industry accolades, including E&Y Entrepreneur of the Year, Regional Winner, and Fortune's Smartest People in Technology. Prior to being a serial entrepreneur, Mark held various investment banking positions. Mark received his BA in Business Management and Economics from Bucknell University. I recently caught up with Mark by phone, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed how he has structured his leadership team at Jet to amplify his own strengths while filling in key gaps in the skills portfolio, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as he discussed his strategic plan and his points of differentiation within his new organization, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
I thought we would begin, Mark, with the background and the company name. How did you select Jet.com as the name of your enterprise?
Yeah, it started out, just had some basic criteria we were looking for. We wanted a name with the starters that was easy to say, spell, and remember. That was kind of just important, just given the amount of money we expected to spend in marketing. We wanted good recall. So that was kind of just the starters. And then wanted a name that was sort of an empty vessel that we felt we could brand into a household name that would work well with millennials, that's sort of a little bit like modern and forward thinking, one that would you could envision being for a kind of new age tech company. But it fit all that criteria of what we were looking for.
No doubt you probably had to procure that from some airline organization of one sort or another, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it was an individual that had it for a long time. It wasn't cheap, the domain, I'll tell you that.
Can't imagine. I can't. I was fascinated, Mark, in doing some homework in preparation for this, that you mentioned that Jet.com will take on the challenge of providing the lowest prices on the internet by overcoming what you've referred to as the gross inefficiencies that hobble e-commerce today. And I wonder if you could take a moment to just sort of describe those gross inefficiencies as well as how they will be overcome.
How do we make the market more efficient?
Yes, exactly. What is the source of the inefficiencies as you see it, and therefore the market opportunity for Jet.com?
I think it's really the efficiency happens in supply chain. Basically, as we're seeing this continued trend of companies adding marketplaces to their website, not just Amazon Marketplace, but there's a whole host of other companies adding marketplaces to their website. I think this is the future. We're going to see more and more marketplaces where retailers are selling on other platforms. And the problem is, and where the inefficiency lies, is that the prices that people sell product for don't change based on, have no relation to the underlying economics of the specific transaction. So what I mean by that is when somebody prices a product on a marketplace, they're wanting to win the buy box. They're wanting to be the merchant that has the lowest price if they win all the sale. But they have to take with the good with the bad. And so if you could imagine a retailer on the East Coast wins the buy box, and now they're winning all the orders, sometimes they have to ship stuff across the country. Sometimes they have to ship stuff. There's just one item. And one item orders and across the country orders are much more expensive than if they were a group of items shipped locally. And they take the good with the bad. They lose on some, they make on others, and on average, they're okay. But that's really inefficient. Ideally, you'd want the order to go to the retailer that has lowest cost economics. And so that would mean that if you bought something and you were located in New York, it would come from a merchant in New York because that merchant had a much lower cost of supply chain to get the product to you. And so on Jet, we sort of have created this back-end rules engine where retailers can preset rules about how they want to compete for business. And we apply those rules in real time as consumers shop to steer them toward more economically efficient orders. And just to give an example of how that works, if you buy a baseball bat and baseball and put it in your basket on Jet, and now you search for a baseball glove, you'll see a bunch of gloves come up. But you'll also notice something else, that some of the gloves have a smart cart bonus. And that's basically savings that we're able to pass back to you for creating a more efficient order. Those smart cart savings on certain gloves mean that that glove can ship together with the bat and ball in your basket in close proximity to you. And so there's a lot of supply chain savings, and we pass those on to you. We're completely transparent with what those savings are. And that will hopefully steer consumers toward more efficient orders and lower prices for the consumer.
Maybe even your example shows this, that perhaps also the advantages of thinking about the peripheral purchases they might make in addition to the primary reason for the purchase, so that, you know, kind of bundling it together will have some advantages versus simply going for the bat without the ball and the glove, so to speak. Is that fair enough,
yeah,
Mark?
Yeah, as you start adding products to the basket and you're adding smart items, that means ones that can be shipped together, the prices of other smart items in the future will continue to come down in price. And they'll keep coming down as you add your fourth thing, your fifth thing, your sixth thing. Prices keep dropping. And the consumer experience is one, it's sort of gamified, but the consumer experience is like, wow, this is incredible. Once you add stuff to your basket, you have a really big incentive to want to keep shopping because the prices are so darn cheap. Well, the prices are so darn cheap because the supply chain costs of getting that product to you could be an approach zero. So if you're already... you have to go pick the stuff. You're already making the box and you're already shipping the box. The marginal cost of supply chain, when I say supply chain, I really mean shipping and fulfillment. The marginal cost of shipping and fulfillment approaches zero after you get so many items in the box. So we want to make that transparent to you, because otherwise you would think, okay, I'm over my free ship minimum. That's good. I'm done. Well, you shouldn't be done, because now is the time to really shop, because now the true costs are actually cheaper now. And just so you know, the shipping and fulfillment represents about 25% of a retailer's revenue, 20 to 25%. So if you think about it, that's an incredibly high cost. Consumers should know that once you got most of that cost covered, because most of the costs are fixed, shipping and fulfillment, most of them are sort of fixed, that once you've got them kind of covered, the prices can be a lot cheaper. And like today, customers just don't know that or understand that. Never mind transparently actually see it. They don't even know it.
And tell me, how do you define the areas of focus for Jet.com? What products or retail segments are you focused on, and which ones are you not?
Yeah, so we're focused on all retail segments. We'll launch with close to 10 million products across every product category. And we'll have prices that are 10 to 15% lower than you'll find anywhere else if you shop in a smart way.
What's the status of Jet today? The most recent announcement I saw was for a July launch. Is that right?
Yeah, we're still on target for that. We haven't set a firm date yet, but still on target for that. Things are going well. We've got tens of thousands of people on shopping on the site now in beta, in this beta group, and we're continuing to work out bugs and kinks and fixed data issues and things. And I think, you know, we'll be in pretty good shape. Every week it gets better. And you know, we continue to add new merchants every day, continue to expand the assortment. Everything's going good. We're up to about 280 people now. We're well staffed. We have close to 100 people in customer care out in Salt Lake City, you know, gearing up, being trained up to handle the volume after launch. And we got 3 warehouses opened up now where we stock our own consumable products, not our own, but we can stock consumable products that we inventory. Everything else outside of consumables. When I say consumables, I mean everyday essentials. Everything outside of the everyday essentials, we optimize the network of retailers that we have on the platform.
What have been some learnings from the beta testing? Are there some things that have surprised you, either pleasantly or unpleasantly?
There's assortment issues, but I think that's basically on cert. There's really a search issue. People had trouble finding products that we actually carried. They weren't finding, saying that we didn't carry stuff. So most of our focus has been on just trying to improve the search so that when you search for something, it gives you what you're looking for. I think a lot of the, like, search will get really smart once you have the actual volume of searches. So it's a little bit of us trying to, like, leg into it a little bit, whereas we're trying to have the best search we can at launch, but not until we get people searching for, I'm looking for, you know, eye redness reducing drops. And that particular search term, it's like, well, when people search that, what do they ultimately look at and buy? Next time somebody searches for that term, we know what they looked at and bought. And so those will, as part of the algorithm, will get surfaced sooner. Like, we don't have the history to be able to do that yet. So there's a little bit of issue there. I think we were surprised too that people were getting confused and didn't think we had the lowest prices on the items that we actually did. And they're just winding up that they're comparing apples to oranges. And so one of the ways that we're going to fix that is that we're launching a price comparison tool on the product detail pages on Jet in the next few weeks. So you'll be able to transparently just see, yeah, there's the price on wherever, and you can click on the link and check on that site, and then you'll see that it is cheaper. So that, I think, will solve that problem. We're also launching a feature that allows you to add, if you see a price cheaper somewhere else, you can just copy the link of where you saw it, add it, you know, copy and paste it into Jet, and then we will make sure that the price you get is at a discount to that price that you saw. Both those things, I think, will solve that problem. So we're kind of like, there's a lot of issues and things that we're learning, and we're just sort of creating things to address them. But overall, I'm feeling great. I'm super excited. I think it's going to be a big launch. We got a lot of marketing dollars that we're going to put to work since we launched in support of the launch. And
very exciting indeed, and what a great idea. Several things you said, what a great idea to do the price comparison, because I would imagine there are probably a lot of consumers who would assume, given, for instance, Amazon's scale, that they might have an advantage to an organization of your vintage and your relative size in terms of their ability to price items. And yeah. So I would imagine that kind of overcoming that perception, obviously with that transparency, for instance, it is you know, an important step in those early days, so people recognize this is not just hype, but actually something you can deliver upon.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing is, I mean, the way we're able to do that primarily in two ways. One is, you know, we don't make a profit on anything we sell. We make all of our profit from the membership. Mm-hmm. So by not making a profit margin, we're able to obviously sell products much cheaper than our competitors. And then you add on top of that, everything we're doing to optimize the supply chain further takes down prices. So it's really like those two things working together that get us to these really attractive prices.
Speaking of which, how did you come up with the annual fee of $49.99? Obviously, that was, especially as you've just mentioned, if that's the source of profitability, obviously that must have taken some thought as to what the figure would be.
Yeah, there's two things really. I mean, but the main thing was just making sure that the relationship between what somebody pays in the membership and what they were likely to save, that made sense. And so if we think the average customer could save $150 to $200 a year, well, you can't charge them $150 for that. You know, so it's some sort of cap on, we wanted to make sure that it was like a no-brainer. And the goal was to show them within the first 3 or 4 months that they can save their entire $50 membership fee. And that kind of felt right. And then if you compare it to other clubs like Costco, which charges $55 a year, we thought that is something that people will probably be comfortable with, since there's 80 million wholesale club members in the U.S.
your time at Quidsy, which obviously is a formative period and a very successful period in among your past entrepreneurial experiences, has been detailed in a whole range of places, including the book The Everything Store, which provided the details of some of the brutal tactics your partner at the time enacted upon you in order to get you to sell the company back in 2011. And I'm curious, what about your experiences, both with Quidsy as well as with Amazon, how that's colored your own perspective now that you are launching another venture within the retail space?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I mean, obviously, I've been in e-commerce now for about a decade, so I've learned a lot, and certainly learned a lot from the experience at Quidsy and even post the sale to Amazon, continue to learn. I think a couple of the big takeaways were I saw the incredible power that Quidsy had on moms, and the beverage kind of had on moms in developing a deep emotional connection. And that was super powerful. And even when in the face of, Amazon at the time dropping the price of diapers by 30%, our moms weren't leaving. And I think we had learned a lot about what it takes to create that deep emotional connection, that it's not one or two things that you do, but it's like the 100 little things. It's how you talk to customers, how you treat customers, and how you build a brand that speaks to them in a way that others don't. So I think I definitely wanted to sort of carry in the whole customer service, and then we handle calls and issues and things. I wanted to take that sort of, it worked really well, and take that to Jet. So we invested heavily in customer service and the brand, little touch points and all the things that connect people in a deep emotional way. So that's kind of the good I took. And then what I learned was just how much e-commerce is a scale game and how powerful price is. Those two things, scale game and how powerful price is. And that far and away, price is the single biggest determinant for whether someone will buy from your site versus another site. I mean, all other things are similar. But I mean, price is a major lever. And at Quidsy, we were higher priced in the competition. And obviously, we're more of a service place. We invested more in service. But anytime we did any sort of price test and things where we brought prices down below the competition, we'd see an order magnitude increase in sales and revenue. And so I experienced firsthand the power of price and also how important it is to get scale to really leverage your fixed infrastructure.
What about customer experience? What insights have you drawn from your several experiences now in retail, online, and e-commerce?
It's 100 little touch points around customer experience that make the difference. It's not one thing. You can't just, it's got to be part of your DNA. It's not just, hey, I'm going to color the box. Now there's going to be this emotional connection. It's every little touch point. It's how you talk to the customer on every interaction. It's the personalized attention, the personalized notes. It's the voice, it's the advertisements, and everything's got to be working together to tell a brand story that is very personalized to the audience that you're targeting.
Interestingly, of course, you have a finance background, and it's very evident even in your responses here and in much that I've read about you in terms of the role that analytics and financial models and the development of algorithms, needless to say, to do the kinds of things that, for instance, Jet.com will be doing in order to develop its pricing models. I'm curious if you can kind of reflect upon the advantages of having grown up in the financial realm in becoming an entrepreneur as opposed to, having been a marketer or having some other sort of business discipline as your primary home in the early stages of your career.
It's funny. I've been really fortunate, I think, to have been exposed to both sides of the brain, both the art and science. I do think in order to be a successful entrepreneur, you need both the art and science. Some people come at it from the sort of art side. Some people come at it from the science side. But if you don't learn the other side and appreciate the other side and gain some balance, it's going to be really tough to be successful. And I've been fortunate enough to be kind of thrown into the softer side when I sold my first company to Topps, the baseball card company, and then went out west and managed a game company, which was all about the art and not about the science at all. And just it was an incredible lesson for me. And then I carried some of that into Quidsy and diapers. And now I'm sort of, I think, squarely in the middle in terms of having that right balance. But it was just kind of by luck. It was not something I set out to do. I got the science side down. I'm going to now learn the art side. It kind of just happened to me, and I learned some lessons and made some decisions along the way that kind of reinforced the importance of art. And the, you know, numbers don't always tell the story, and knowing when to use numbers and when not, and when is it art, is kind of that's the secret.
In each of these entrepreneurial experiences, as you've built teams and perhaps, I don't know, reflected upon, you know, gaps that you were hoping to close, but nevertheless, especially in your early days, you know, gaps to your background that might be filled by somebody else. And now, of course, as you've mentioned, so many of the gaps have been filled simply by experience. How have you thought about kind of filling in your executive team? What kinds of backgrounds do you look for? What are the kinds of experiences prior to joining, for instance, Jet.com, that lead you to conclude that someone is oriented towards being successful in this enterprise?
First, I'll say that I think we have an amazing team. A few of the people were actually part of the exec team at Quidsi that came up with me, so they were sort of handpicked and already knew that they were amazing at what they do and certainly had relevant experience. And then sort of rounded it out with a few more people that did not work with me. And I think the key in just with any hiring, exec or otherwise, starts with alignment with respect to the core values of the company. And I think that's probably the single biggest factor in creating a high performance management team, is that this alignment on core values, and you know, each bring their own unique perspectives and strengths in their areas, but this core value alignment. And that's the way, you know, teams gel best. So that's the most important and trumps everything else. And I pride myself in you know, having very low turnover in the company in general, and even more so at the executive management level.
Mm-hmm. And what role, especially in these early days where there's just so much change, so much momentum, so much need to grow and get to that scale that you described before, which is so important, what role does strategy play? How do you think about kind of putting a stake in the ground to help kind of declare the direction the organization needs to go? And how malleable does that need to be in these early days where, for instance, in these beta tests, you're learning things, as you mentioned before, and needing to course correct or seize an advantage you didn't realize that was there for the taking? What role does strategy play, strategic planning, communication of those plans, et cetera, play day in, day out in these stages, especially of the business's evolution?
It's funny you ask that question, because that is where I spend most of my time. Basically, having painting a clear vision for that North Star and the broad strategic ways in which we're going to approach the business to get there. And then just continuing to communicate that, because, you know, when it comes to strategy, you know, you're making a choice, and if your strategic choice doesn't have two sides of the argument, then it's not really a strategy. If it's sort of so clear as day, this is what you need to do, it's not a strategy. Strategy involves making a very specific choice and a tough decision about the path that you're going to take to get somewhere. And it could just as easily have been a different path. And so there's always nuances around what exactly do you mean when you say this. And so just continuing to articulate that, not only at all hands, which we do, we share the board presentations with the entire company to try to really empower people. That's one of our core values, is transparency, trying to be really open with information and sharing information. But then just, you know, talking to individuals in the company one-on-one and reiterating the strategy and trying to translate what they're working on into the bigger picture so that they're empowered to kind of make the right decisions, because they are looking at the vision and strategy through the same lens that me and the management team are. And that's really, I think that goes a little bit undervalued sometimes in startups, but it pays huge dividends if you get that right. Because as you're growing so fast, you know, you want all the people coming to the organization to kind of be looking through the same lens so that you don't need to micromanage and you don't need to be involved in every decision, because you know that they're thinking about things in a very strategically aligned way.
The last question I wanted to ask you, Mark, is who have been the people who've been particularly influential to you as a business leader, as you think back across your time in business, your time as an entrepreneur? Who are some of those people who really kind of helped shape the leader that you are?
I think I've been really fortunate to have great managers throughout my career. So I would say, you know, at Credit Suisse, at Sanwa Bank, at Tops when I sold the business, those were three managers that I had that all in different ways helped to shape the leader I am today. I think that at the end of the day, the thing that all three of them had in common was just an incredible ability to lead by example and empower, and empower people. And I think that's what we're all about here. Our mission here is to empower people to live brilliantly. That's kind of what our stated mission is. And I do believe in the power of empowerment. And that all three of the managers that I had early in my career did that really well. And I saw how much it motivated me and how much happier I was working in that type of environment. So I would say it's just those three managers.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking time. It's a pleasure to meet you and to speak with you and appreciate your time, especially during a very, very busy period for you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks. Anytime. Happy to chat. It was great talking to you.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.